Welcome to the big interview on the July 3rd iteration of Money Life. And I'm joined right now by David Luchenko, who is partner and portfolio manager at Chautauqua Capital. It is chautauquacapital.com. I would spell it for you, but that would just confuse you. So if you want to go learn about the firm, make sure you find David on our guest page or in our show notes, and there will be a link that gets you directly to chautauquacapital.com without forcing you to spell it. David Luchenko, it's great to have you back on Money Life.
Good to be here. Thank you, Chuck.
So I'm super excited to have you back because it's been a while. In fact, the last time you were on the show was just over 2 years ago, and you and I were talking at Morningstar, and I didn't actually even go to the Morningstar Investment Conference this year. That was a thing about my personal life, not about Morningstar. But at the time, well, you were on the day after David Giroux, star manager at T. Rowe Price, said there's absolutely no reason for investors to invest internationally. They can do everything they want with domestic stocks and buying U.S. multinational companies. And you came on and said foreign stocks are poised to carry the next market cycle, and there is a distinct reason why you should own them, and now's the time to make sure you have them. And maybe the next market cycle hasn't started yet, but that hasn't quite come true. Now, we're looking at really interesting market times. But for you, is there a reason why that didn't happen, or did that not happen yet? And it's still coming.
Thanks for the question, and thanks for having us back on. And by no means do I want to get in a debate with David. Suffice to say, the U.S. markets have been carrying the day. And I guess in 22, international, measured by the indices, had a slight outperformance in a down year. But look, if you go back to 2000 and you're keeping track annually of what the scorecard is, it's like a football game. U.S. is up 14 years, international 10 years. And as you look back over history at rolling 5-year rolling return periods going back to the 70s, you know, cycles of U.S. and international leadership tend to be long and varied. Prior to the most recent U.S. dominance, there was a long period of international outperformance in the 2000s and several years in the 1980s and the 1970s. You might recall back in the 80s, that was high growth rates in Asia, a boost in Asian markets, particularly in Japan. You know, subsequently at the beginning of this, you know, the 2000s to 2010s, China joined the WTO and capital flows into China and the broader BRICS. And so, you know, with relative underperformance of international equities, again, approaching historical extremes in both duration and magnitude, our experience indicates that international stocks are due to reclaim some sort of market leadership in the next cycle, whenever that may begin.
How much will they be helped along, and will they perhaps get an edge by the fact that foreign central banks have already started to act on cutting interest rates and the U.S. has not? And how big a deal is it if the U.S. and foreign central banks get out of sync?
So central bank policy is interesting, right? Because that had an impact on U.S. leadership and international, depending on which foreign banks are doing what and making it easier in terms of monetary conditions in their world. And I think that relates to the strength of the U.S. dollar, because we've been in a period for the past 10 years where you've been in a dollar strength environment. I don't have the latest statistics, but if you went back over the past 10 years, I think it's probably 200 plus annualized basis points of an advantage for US over foreign investors. So if you were to see a weakening in the US dollar, that would no longer be a headwind for US investors investing internationally.
We're having a discussion about why international markets haven't carried the day, but why they're poised to carry the day. And we have not said one word about two wars that are currently ongoing and have been for a while and that show no real signs of going anyplace. Has the impact of those been less than we would have expected? Or is the impact of those, the real impact of those, coming and it's just delayed, kind of like the inverted yield curve? You know, you see it, but it doesn't mean you're going to see the impact for 2 years.
The world is a messy place, and it's interesting. I think we hear and read about a lot of what's going on around the world, whether it's wars. And I would often ask people to put ourselves in another country and consider picking up a paper and reading about the situation that's going on here, at least in the political sense. So, you know, is our home as clean as it has always been? I think that the wars have had an impact, certainly, on supply chains and some of the demand that's existing around the country and the world. But, you know, from our perspective, it's interesting. We look at companies, not countries. And so, you know, our belief has always been that markets are emotional and short-term oriented. And as a result, securities of what we call advantaged wealth-generating businesses are oftentimes mispriced because most investors don't fully comprehend the company's potential for sustained high growth and improved profitability. We think the best way to exploit that phenomenon on a company-by-company basis is to find these businesses and to invest with a long time horizon. So big data is certainly one of the big trends that's out there in the marketplace, certainly driving a very narrow market here in the United States. And as you consider some of the trends that are going on and have gone on in big data, maybe I can just back up a bit because this relates to, you know, yes, wars are going on, but this big data trend is continuing. You know, back in 2010, you had 2 zettabytes of data creation essentially in the year. And by 2020, that exploded to 62 zettabytes, which, by the way, exceeds the number of detectable stars in the universe. And last year, the world created double that to 120 zettabytes. And if you extrapolate that to next year, it's estimated that we're going to have 463 exabytes of data that will be created each day globally. So if I can take you back to 2010, that is essentially the same amount of data each day that we're going to be created that we created in a quarter in 2010. So, you know, I guess my point is you have some long-lived themes and trends that are carrying the day. And our job here really isn't to predict what's going to happen with central bank policy or what's going to happen in a regional or a global conflict. We do talk about those as they relate to our individual companies. But, you know, as an example on big data, in our international fund, you know, we have 2 wonderful companies that we've owned for 13 and 14 years that are key enablers and beneficiaries of these big technology trends that dominate the popular press. And, you know, one happens to be in Taiwan and the other is in the Netherlands. And a lot of what you get at the leading edge wouldn't be possible without those 2 companies today, as an example.
It's interesting to me because there's a couple things I want to dig into there. And I should point out to my audience that, you know, I throw out your titles, partner and portfolio manager, but you're part of portfolio construction and market analysis. And as you said, you guys dig in at the company level and you worry not at all about the country level. But is the country level at least a tiebreaker? I mean, if I showed you a balance sheet that was, you know, at the edge where you're going, this is becoming buyable to us. But I said, I'm not telling you the country it is. So you look at the numbers and you do your research and go, I like the looks of this. And then I tell you this one is in China and that one is in the Netherlands, since you just happened to mention, you know, one from there. Does that make a difference? Sure. I mean, at that point, does country make a difference?
So I don't want to say we ignore it altogether. Certainly it's part of the thesis, but since you brought up China, you know, I'd say we're as clear-eyed and vigilant on the macro risks of our companies that we face as we are on the individual growth runways and competitive position that they have. So China, there's a prominence of risk stories in the business and popular press, and it's weighed heavily on investor sentiment on those equities. So, you know, our names in China aren't a call on their economy, but rather the sectors that they're involved in because they're aligned with government initiatives, right? I mean, our select companies are in sectors that are not facing geopolitical risk. It's in healthcare, where the government has an interest in improving their delivery to an aging population. It's in consumer e-commerce players. And we think that that has its own regulatory cycle, which we think is passed. But we're cognizant of the risks involved in China and are about benchmark weight in select companies in that region. So I would say, to your question, yes, the political risk holds us back from increasing exposures in the region, but we want to be smart about how we play there because it's an incredibly large country. You know, you consider the growth of the middle class, it's essentially Asia. And if you consider there are, I think, 100 million people entering the global middle class each year, we're going from 4 billion to, I think, 5 billion by 2031. And 91 out of the 112 million that enter every year are from Asia. And 31 of those are from China, 33 million from India, 5 million from Indonesia. So those are places that we want to be anchored to because those are some wonderful consumers that can support prospects for our global companies. But yeah, there are regions where we don't have exposure. And that's what's great about running a 30-stock portfolio. We don't have to have exposure to all geographic regions around the world. And again, we're looking at companies over countries is kind of how we think about that.
Well, let's also dig in at the company level, because one of the other things you mentioned was valuations here in the U.S. being higher and valuations internationally being better at this point. We've had a market here where, yes, we've got the market at record high levels or near record high levels, but it's been carried by a few names. So since the market's current move has been so narrow, is the discrepancy in valuations as big as you might have expected if I told you we're going to see a market at record high levels?
So we just finished the first half of the year, and I noticed that the S&P 500 return, to your point, is up 15%. Microsoft, NVIDIA, Google, Amazon, Meta contributed 62% of that index return. Incidentally, we do own NVIDIA, Google, and Amazon in our global portfolio and have for a long time. But the equal weight S&P 500 returned 5% versus 15%. So clearly, these U.S. companies have wonderful businesses, and it's shown in the price. So as you look at valuation ranges across regions, the U.S. is expensive relative to its own history. And the valuation difference between the U.S. and international markets today, international markets are always undervalued, by the way, and that's partly the way that the indexes are constructed, because the international indexes have more value-oriented sectors than growth, which the S&P has in it. But nonetheless, you know, that variation that we exist today, I think makes a strong case for international investing, makes it appealing. But, you know, if you were to even think a little bit further out, and instead of just thinking about PE today, 12-month forward PE, you know, if you were to look at the CAPE ratio for U.S. equities, it's 33.7. Europe's at 21.5. China, incidentally, is at 11.5. But then you also have India that is at 36.9. A lot of people have high prospects for growth coming out of India. So yeah, a lot of times when you have a concentrated market, that portends for some change. And I think another reason why it makes sense to have a diversified approach to an overall portfolio, not advocating not investing in these wonderful companies. We're just saying that it's good to have a diversified approach.
I want to go back at something you mentioned there about owning three members of the Magnificent Seven, having also mentioned that your portfolios are concentrated. And I want to point out, you were very clear that those are in your global portfolios, your global growth portfolios. But the headline this whole year has been on the weightings of the Magnificent Seven taking up so much space in the index. So help somebody understand how, if they're investing with you or anyone like you, because this happens all the time, we talk to a lot of people on the show who own those stocks, they're still getting appropriate diversification and performance that is not so tied to the same things?
I love this question because I think it goes right back to our goal. So we're investors, and our goal as investors is to outperform our relative benchmark as an active manager on a rolling five-year period, because we always ask ourselves, what can this company look like in 5 years? And so we think that's a better way to gauge the success of our diversified 30-stock international or diversified 40-stock global growth portfolio. And incidentally, both of our strategies have outperformed 100% of the time on a rolling five-year basis, going back to the inception of the products back in 2009. And so when you look at shorter time periods, like the current one that we're in, it's really hard to keep pace with a market that has that kind of narrowness. If you only own, in our opinion, the three, you know, that fit within our lenses that we consider, but you don't own them all, and you also have to own them at weight. It's interesting, Chuck. I had an investor the other day say, "Hey, David, your benchmark is the S&P 500," and I said, "It's actually not." But I think that's telling, because I think most investors think that's all that you need is, you know, to own the Mag 7, or, you know, and certainly that has worked. But while history doesn't repeat itself, it oftentimes rhymes. And I think a more diversified approach, you know, having exposure to big data and having exposure to GLP-1s, we own Novo as an example. Eli Lilly is the popular name here in the United States, but also having a diversified approach as it relates to, you know, one of the largest outsourced IT services company, or, you know, we talked about growth of the middle class in Asia. diversifying into the largest private bank in India, a wonderful company. Or, you know, e-commerce adoption, another great theme in the portfolio. A lot of people are familiar with it here in the United States. Heck, in COVID, we all embraced it and we continue to do it today. But it might surprise some listeners that retail e-commerce sales, you know, compounded annual growth rates over the next 5 years, 9% here in the U.S., but it's 11.5% estimated in India, 9.9% in China, 9.6% in Indonesia. So they're even stronger. Factory automation, you know, that's a trend that's really important to reduce labor costs and improve manufacturing efficiency. You know, important as formerly low-cost manufacturing centers like China are no longer low-cost from a labor cost perspective. So, you know, we own a great company whose vision systems and sensors to robots dramatically expands their use cases as well as improves their productivity. And so as a investment firm that's focused on helping our investors outperform the index over rolling five-year periods, we can't get caught up in the chase game in the shorter time periods of, you know, 6 to 12 to 18 months. It always exhibits itself. So that's the way we've approached it.
I'm curious. I asked the question earlier about wars and how that was affecting things. And to a great extent, it wasn't. But if wars aren't affecting things, my assumption would be the election is an event you are curious about, you want to watch, et cetera, but not something that you think is going to impact what you do in the least. Or am I wrong about that?
I would say not in the least. There are always impacts. Clearly, one party or the other will have different policies that might affect renewables and EVs. It's not as if who wins the White House doesn't have any significance on the investments that we make. Of course they do. But the companies we want to have in the portfolio, we want to have companies that have staying power. They benefit from these long-term trends. You know, they have resiliency in their business model so that if business gets hard for them because of a war or an election or a policy, but we still believe in the long-term trend and they're the best company in the sector to realize that goal, you know, oftentimes our companies come out of those environments stronger. And so, you know, we have a low turnover strategy. We're 10 to 15% out of the 40 names that we own in the global. The 30 names in the non-US markets are the same. But, you know, I would say that our new name exposure is 2 to 4 new names a year. And, you know, we want to be mindful of that. So will we be paying attention to who takes the office and the potential policies that might come from that? Absolutely. At the end of the day, again, I would fall back to this idea that we want to find these advantage companies that benefit from long-term trends, possess those advantages that enable them to capture the lion's share of the profits created by those trends. And of course, we are a growth manager, but we want to purchase them at a reasonable valuation. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens in this election cycle and what opportunities it might afford an active manager like Chautauqua.
Yes, it will be interesting indeed. I've got more questions, but I'm out of time. So as we watch what happens and it plays out, hopefully we'll get you back after the election and we'll talk about where things have moved to then. David, thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Chuck, thank you. Have a great 4th of July.
You too. That's David Lubchenco, everybody. He is partner and portfolio manager at Chautauqua Capital. It's chautauquacapital.com. By the way, they're on Twitter at RW Baird because they are part of the Baird family. So at RW Baird, if you're looking for more information. And we'll be back with the market call. So stick around. This is Money Life.